This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
While we in the United States have been pretty absorbed with our election, it's not too much to say that the conflict in Syria is shaking the entire globe. To put this in a little more context, I wanted to talk with two colleagues at The New Yorker, Dexter Filkins and Robin Wright, two staff writers for The New Yorker who have for years and years been reporting on wars throughout the Middle East.
I've covered every war, revolution, and uprising in the Middle East since 1973, and this is the first time that I've had to cover a war from the periphery. And to get access is just logistically very difficult. And of course, those who have tried have faced dire consequences, including being beheaded.
Because it seems to me this is the first time that journalists can't use their their status as a journalist as a shield, but rather it's the opposite, isn't it, Dexter?
Yeah, it used to be a shield. I'm an American journalist.
When did that stop?
Well, it stopped in the Iraq War now you're practically asking to be shot. I mean, you can just imagine driving into northern Syria now from, say, the Turkish border. How long would your life expectancy be? Not long. I think the real sad part about that is that because the journalists can't go in there and put a face on all this and show us people, the war has become an abstraction. So it's the most catastrophic event in recent times, maybe 400,000 people dead.
Now, the Obama administration has basically ruled out direct intervention in Syria and seriously has ruled out any military engagement of any scale. And there's a kind of fatalism to that about making the situation better in the long term. Is President Obama right about that?
There were never any great options for the United States, particularly in the aftermath of the intervention in Iraq. The model in Iraq, where we had no-fly zones in the north and the south, don't really work in Syria. Helping the rebels, that was an option. Did you want to arm them? The danger is the rebels themselves have not been very organized. They haven't been very efficient. They haven't put forward a viable political alternative to President Assad. So even though we all wish there was more the United States or the outside world could do, the options have always been very complicated and endangered deeper involvement, boots on the ground, and a bigger deployment in Syria than we had in Iraq or Afghanistan.
So, Robin, you essentially agree with the president. Dexter, do you?
Well, I think what's frustrating about President Obama's approach to Syria has been it's never been a priority for him. It's fair to say when he looks at Syria, he sees Iraq. He sees Baghdad in 2003. If we go in, we are not going to know what we're doing, and we're only going to make it worse. So he's backed out. He's stayed away. And so, yes, there's these kind of half-hearted efforts to arm rebels and half-hearted efforts to engage in peace talks. But it's never really gotten the president's full weight behind it. And I think the effect of that has been to open a big vacuum into which the Iranians, the Russians, Hezbollah, every Sunni crazy group that we can think of in the Arab world have rushed in.
Let me just say there's a bigger issue as an undercurrent to all of this, and that is, are the current states in the Middle East something that the United States wants to use its human treasure, its financial capital, its international leverage to try to retain. Syria and Iraq were divided up a century ago by French and British powers. There are arguments that they never really reflected the local realities, the division of power, the tribal alliances, and so forth. Are these frail states held together by autocrats, dictators, viable long-term? And I think that's a question that Washington has been unwilling to tackle.
So the war in Syria started in a way that was very reminiscent of other Arab revolutions, Arab Spring revolutions. Why did this get to the point where there are nearly 500,000 dead and 11 million refugees?
Well, if you look back to Daraa, where the uprising started, I think that's a pretty good place to start, because the demonstrations against the government began peacefully. People gathered. They protested. Some of them called for an end to Assad's regime. The regime responded brutally. There's a famous anecdote of a young boy who was taken away, tortured, and mutilated, and then his corpse was dumped on the front steps of his family's home. And that's probably the best explanation we have, which is that the middle ground has been taken away. And it very rapidly became a fight to the death, which it is now.
There was no possibility in Assad's mind or means for some kind of accommodation.
Well, Assad, I think, had managed to hang on to power in part by molding together an array of minorities inside Syria, which is one of the richest melting pots in the region. And the rule of thumb is if a dictator can hold on to 30% of the population, he has enough manpower to provide police forces, to man the military. And so he had enough support to deploy a military against the majority, which is Sunni in Syria. And so the dynamics inside Syria were always a little different from the other countries and made it easier, particularly knowing what happened, he knew to move quickly.
It's kind of amazing that the Assad family has persisted this long and that Assad, in this case, has persisted throughout this war. We would have been shocked to know that he would have lasted to 2016, no? It's
pretty remarkable. I mean, I was speaking to somebody very close to the regime just the other day, and he said the secret to Assad's survival has been his intelligence service, that it's everywhere. They're very good. They're ruthless. And they're very good at what they do, and their mission is essentially to hold the country together at all costs.
And how do they do that?
Well, there are multiple intelligence agencies, and they all report at the same time. And you can walk into a hotel in Damascus, and there will be probably agents from four or five different intelligence services all monitoring everything you do. But one of the things that the Assad dynasty has always done is use its cousins, its relatives. There is a network of families loyal to Assad. His cousin runs everything from the telecommunications to the Dunkin' Donuts franchise and is also big in the intelligence community. Assad has also done something since the beginning of the war in empowering local figures, local militias, basically. They've become like little warlords. As people have defected from the military, as the numbers have been whether killed off or injured, he's relied increasingly on local forces outside Damascus to hold on to their neighborhoods. And that's been another very important strategy in dominating the areas that he still controls.
I think what's interesting here is if you look at Assad's group, the main group, the Alawites, if he had just had to rely on them and the other minorities, as Robin said, that he've gathered around him, it's not enough. The regime would have fallen by now were it not for all the foreign players who have rushed into the country, the Russians, the Iranians, Hezbollah. So that now, for instance, with Aleppo, what was Syria's largest city before the war started, now under siege, the manpower for that offensive, it's being sustained by foreigners. It's a terrifying prospect. If you look down the road, where does this end? They must look at themselves and worry whether the Alawites as a group can survive.
Robin, the Pentagon spent about $500 million trying to create a rebel force in Syria, a project which produced about four or five fighters. What went wrong?
One of the great problems was the disparate nature of the opposition. I met with 31 military commanders from Aleppo about 18 months ago. And I was struck by the fact that there was a rivalry among them when they tried to form a united high command, that it would last a week or two, and then one of them would break away and say, no, I'm forming a new high command, and I'm the new leader. And the problem after 5.5 years is also that there's been a great deal of corruption. There is an interest in some ways in perpetuating the conflict because of the warlordism. The aid going in has been ripped off and exploited. It's being sold by some of those who intercept it, some of those who receive it. And there is something about the psychology of war. I saw it during the 15 years of Lebanon Civil War, that it went on longer and longer and longer, in part because that's what became the state. That's what became how people got their incomes, how they got their jobs, and how they got their access to power.
Robin, in some sense, the Syrian society increasingly breaking down along tribal or neighborhood lines. How can this be repaired in any way?
I fear we've gone beyond the point that Syria can be reconstituted as it was in the past. There's been, in the background of all this fighting, an enormous amount of ethnic cleansing, groups that have left entirely the areas they inhabited. The mix that was once Syria has separated. And in many ways, the future of this country is going to be decided by outsiders. And the fact that the opposition has not provided a viable political alternative or a viable military alliance to fight the regime effectively. The Russians and the Iranians have both said to the United States, you know, who's the alternative? And the fact is that people in Washington will tell you there isn't one yet.
Dexter, I got to say, I'm thinking about the listener at home, and he or she is in the kitchen or cleaning up, and they're hearing about the various conflicts, the various factions, and it's almost like it's too much to understand and then too much, tragically, to find a way to care about it, much less to do anything about it. And all one wants to know is, how does this end?
Yeah, it's hard to see. I think that if you just take what Robin just laid out, this kaleidoscope of rebel groups, none of whom can get together with each other, this is what the White House sees. I don't want to go too far with this, but I think what we're seeing is a slow realization that probably the Syrian regime will have to stay for a while, if not Assad himself.
What's in it for Russia, Dexter? Why is Russia so invested in backing Assad and doing things like grotesque things, like attacking aid convoys with bombs?
In a way, for Russia, they see this through the prism of self-interest, which is they have their own Muslim populations to worry about. There are many Chechens who are fighting in Syria and other parts of Iraq. But I think it's also fair to say that the vacuum left by whether it's the United States or the European Union, has created an opening for Putin, and he's seized on it, and I think he sees it as a way for Russia to assert its power.
Syria is the strategic center of the Middle East. It borders all the major players, and whoever controls Syria has enormous leverage on what happens on all of those borders. That's one reason that Putin has such a stake in Syria, despite the costs.
You heard Donald Trump the other night, the debate, say that we're admitting hundreds of thousands of refugees from Syria. None of you know, we don't know who they are, et cetera, et cetera. If only it were true. This is precisely what the White House says. They say the one thing we can do is help refugees. And we're spending more than any other country to do that. We're spending more than $1 billion
a year. What you're saying, that resettlement in the West, whether it's Europe or the United States, is the only viable option for these people.
Well, they face very dire choices. There are refugee camps, as you've covered, in Jordan. I've seen them in Iraq, in Turkey. They wander the streets of Lebanon, where they're now almost 25% of the population. The choice is, can they find homes someplace overseas? It's a very hot potato issue in Europe. Angela Merkel faces real resistance because she's promised to take in almost 1 million. In the United States, even 10,000 is a very controversial issue. So there aren't many options, even for the refugees who do want to go overseas, who do have skills and may even have a little bit of resources.
Emma Skye, the British diplomat, said to me recently, you can actually imagine that the crisis could bring about the end of the European Union. If the flow of refugees continues, it will put governments like Angela Merkel under increasing pressure, you can actually see the European Union breaking up over this.
Robin Wright, Dexter Filkins, thank you.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.